Simpson writes of the evolution of liberation or rollback philosophy into a major influence on the Republican 1952 presidential campaign, and he describes it as follows. Neither the Eastern European exile community in America, nor still less the minority of former Nazi collaborators among them, had the political muscle to force adoption of a liberation agenda on the American public by themselves. But they could, and did, often serve as catalysts that helped trigger the much bigger political, quote, chemical reaction, unquote, so to speak, that was then underway, the primary ingredients of which were East-West disputes over economic and military spheres of influence. The first, and in some ways most credible spokesman in the United States for liberationist thinking, were exiled activists who were, like NTS executive Konstantin Bolderev, discussed above, quote, well known to American intelligence and vouched for by high American officials, unquote. Their message and slogans caught on with millions of Americans during the first half of the 1950s, especially among conservatives and others alarmed by the spread of communism abroad. In 1952, the public support in the United States for threats to liberate Eastern Europe and the USSR from their communist governments was sufficiently broad that the Republican Party adopted an explicit call for liberation as the main foreign policy plank in its party platform and as a central theme in its presidential and congressional election campaigns. Again, in 1952, the public support in the United States for threats to liberate Eastern Europe and the USSR from their communist governments was sufficiently broad that the Republican Party adopted an explicit call for liberation as the main foreign policy plank in its party platform and as a central theme in its presidential and congressional election campaigns. The Republicans' campaign platform demanded, quote, the end of the negative, futile, and immoral policy of, quote, containment, unquote, as the New York Times reported, again quoting, which abandons countless human beings to a despotism and godless terrorism, unquote. The GOP pledged to, quote, revive the contagious, liberating influences that are inherent in freedom and to mark the, quote, beginning of the end, unquote, for Communist Party rule in Eastern Europe and the USSR. America, the Republicans' primary foreign policy spokesman John Foster Dulles wrote in Life magazine, quote, wants and expects liberation to occur, unquote. This anti-communist revolution, he claimed disingenuously, would come about, quote, peacefully, unquote. The Republicans used this liberation rhetoric as a means of distinguishing their promises of a new, tougher foreign policy from the program of the Democrats. What exactly Eisenhower intended to do to promote the liberation of Eastern Europe once the election campaign was over, however, was usually left vague. Arthur Bliss Lane, who had been U.S. ambassador to Poland during the Truman years, became the point man in the Republican Party's effort to swing the enthusiasm created by the Crusade for Freedom into the GOP's column during the 1952 election. Lane's inspiration was to attract the large Slavic and Eastern European voting blocs in the United States, which had traditionally voted for Democratic candidates, to the Republican Party through demagogic promises to, quote, liberate, unquote, their former homelands with American assistance. Along with his party assignment, Lane, as noted earlier, simultaneously served on the boards of both the NCFE and the CFF, and he was an indefatigable speaker and promoter on behalf of each of his causes. Soon, Republican election tactics in ethnic communities paralleled the CIA's Crusade for Freedom campaign so closely that considerable political sophistication was required to distinguish one from the other. The party-sponsored Committee of Crusades to Lift the Iron Curtain, Liberation Centers, Liberation Week festivities, and Liberation rallies designed to draw ethnic voters into the Republican camp. These campaigns imitated and sometimes overlapped the CFF's Freedom Weeks, Baltic Freedom Days, and Freedom Rallies. Speakers and local activists of the True Crusades were frequently the same people. Several of Lane's top ethnic advisors personified the gradual evolution from World War II collaboration into Cold War liberation advocacy that has been seen in the CIA's propaganda programs. Lane, specialist in Republican Party appeals to Americans of Russian and Ukrainian ethnic descent, for example, was the scholar and publicist Vladimir Petrov, P-E-T-R-O-V. Petrov, a survivor of Stalin's prison camps in the 1930s, had defected to the Germans early in the war and spent much of the conflict assigned to a Nazi-sponsored propaganda group in Vienna, according to his own account, and as a publicist promoting Vlasov's, quote, Russian Army of Liberation, unquote. Petrov also served as a Quisling city administrator in Krasnodar in the USSR during the Nazi occupation. Krasnodar is K-R-A-S-N-O-D-A-R, by the way. Continuing. He insisted in a recent interview that he had no knowledge when he was serving in Krasnodar of the Nazis' gas truck extermination program which was introduced in Krasnodar during Petrov's tenure as transportation and finance chief. The Germans killed at least 7,000 people in this manner during Petrov's brief time in office, then used collaborationist militia troops to shoot others in tank ditches on the outskirts of town. During the 1952 election campaign, Petrov served both as an advisor to Lane and as a leading Russian-language journalist in the ethnic press in this country. The gradual merging of the Republicans' election campaign and the crusade for freedom reached its logical culmination on the eve of the 1952 election. The party's ethnic division under Lane approved and allocated money for a psychological warfare tactic that had earlier been used by the CIA in Italy and Eastern Europe. Millions of yellow leaflets were slated to be dropped from airplanes, quote, over places such as Hamtramck, unquote, the large immigrant community near Detroit, plugging Eisenhower and blaming Democrat Adlai Stevenson for the, quote, betrayal, unquote, of the Slavic, quote, fatherland and relatives, unquote, to the communists. Hamtramck, by the way, is H-A-M-T-R-A-M-C-K. Continuing. The yellow paper was to dramatize the leaflet's conclusion. Quote, if you men and women of Polish and Czech descent can, after reading the above, vote for the Democratic candidate, the handbill proclaimed, you are as yellow as this paper. Everything was ready to go within 48 hours, according to correspondence in Lane's archives, but Eisenhower's inner circle of election advisors canceled the plan at the last minute. Eisenhower's election campaign was successful in any event. Lane's, quote, ethnic, unquote, campaign produced mixed results. The Republicans did draw substantially more votes from ethnic districts than they had been able to do previously, according to contemporary reports, although the Democratic Party's influence in these wards was by no means extinguished. In any case, the majority of American voters backed Eisenhower, at least in part because of his pro-liberation, quote, let's get tough with the communists' foreign policy stance. In January of 1953, the first Republican administration in 20 years entered Washington with a grand inaugural parade and a rhetorical commitment, at least, to a mission to liberate Eastern Europe from communist rule. Now, again, summing up what we've looked at here, we have looked at the evolution of liberation, originally a Third Reich political and then covert action, political warfare and covert action technique, into a mainstream American political force and a dominant influence in the 1952 Republican campaigns, both at the presidential and congressional levels. I would also note that the point man for the Republicans, Arthur Bliss Lane, was on the board of both the NCFE and the CFF, the two CIA organizations that were instrumental in projecting these Galen-related émigrés into American political life, where they served as the core and the catalyst for the generation of, quote, liberation or rollback theory into a major American political force. Also note that a CIA psychological warfare technique that was used in Italy and Eastern Europe was going to be used by Arthur Bliss Lane in the closing days of the 52 Republican campaign, but that Eisenhower's advisors nixed it. And also note that the main functionary for Arthur Bliss Lane in his Republican pro-liberation campaign, which, as Simpson notes, became indistinguishable in time from the CFF's program, the CIA program, was this fellow Vladimir Petrov, again, a Third Reich collaborator, and he was the transportation and finance chief in the Nazi-occupied city of Krasnodar, when thousands of people were being gassed in the so-called Gaswagen, the mobile gas chambers that were developed by Walter Rauf, an SS war criminal who also worked in conjunction with U.S. intelligence in Chile and other places. We've looked at that in past broadcasts. And again, at least in part, because of the pro-liberation campaign of Arthur Bliss Lane, the Republicans were elected, although they did not dominate these ethnic communities. They ultimately were able to greatly increase their electoral success, and they came to power with at least a rhetorical commitment to liberate Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union. Again, what we're going to look at now is yet another way in which these Galen and Third Reich-related elements came to play a significant role in American political life. And what we're going to be seeing here is the active collaboration between these Third Reich alumni, so to speak, and related elements, and the American radical right. And ultimately, the hookup between some of these same elements, these Third Reich residua, and the American radical right produced the liberation milieu. What we're going to look at is their operation at the executive level, but the projection of these Galen-related elements into American political life as a result of the CFF campaign for generating pro-liberation sentiment in the United States, and again, that among other things, to generate American popular support for an enormous arms buildup, this led to the synthesis of domestic American reactionaries, national security elements, and Galen and Third Reich-related elements that we looked at in the explicitly fascist milieu, which was at the core of the assassination of President Kennedy, literally a fascist coup in the United States. And don't forget that George Herbert Walker Bush, as we looked at in the first installment of this archive show, is part and parcel to this milieu. Returning to Blowback by Christopher Simpson, we're going to take a look at now how former U.S. intelligence operative John Frenchie Grombach, again G-R-O-M-B-A-C-H, put together an intelligence network of former SS officers and Third Reich collaborators, and how this organization originally worked on contract to the CIA, although it was never under any official Washington control. And then we're going to see how John Frenchie Grombach, who aspired to become CIA director, put this organization to work on behalf of Senator Joe McCarthy in McCarthy's attempts to purge Eisenhower appointees who didn't meet his standards. Simpson writes, "During the late 1940s, Grombach had become a businessman who specialized in selling political and economic intelligence derived in large part from old boy networks of German SS officers, former Hungarian Axis Quislings and Russian nationalist NTS men to the State Department, the CIA, and corporate customers in the United States and Western Europe. Grombach's espionage network operated through and was partially financed by the N.V. Philips Gluilenamfenfabriken Corporation of the Netherlands and its American affiliate Philips North America, according to reports found in his CIC dossier." That name's N.V. Philips, G-L-O-E-I-L-A-M-P-E-N-F-A-B-R-I-E-K-E-N. Continuing, "This was the same major electronics manufacturer that had provided a channel for his clandestine wartime operations. One of Grombach's most important assets, according to U.S. naval intelligence records obtained under the Freedom of Information Act, was SS General Karl Wolff, W-O-L-F-F, a major war criminal who had gone into the arms trade in Europe after the war. A second primary component of Grombach's private intelligence apparat was a large group of Hungarians loyal to the former royal privy councillor Tibor Eckhart, according to Ray Litalo, who handled liaison with Grombach's undercover service for State Department intelligence." Tibor Eckhart is T-I-B-O-R-E-C-K-H-A-R-D-T. Ray Litalo, Y-L-I-T-A-L-O. By the way, I would interject at this point that Karl Wolff was Himmler's personal adjutant. He was also the commander of all SS forces in Italy during the war. And the aforementioned Giro von Gebernitz, the fellow who helped work out the Christian West concept on behalf of the Third Reich and cooperating with Alan Dulles, was instrumental in helping to effect the surrender of the SS forces in Italy under Karl Wolff to the very same Alan Dulles. Of course, von Gebenitz then played a key role in convincing General Edwin Siebert of U.S. military intelligence to bring Galen on board. Karl Wolff, again, was a major war criminal, Himmler's personal adjutant. I would also note here, before we continue, that the Grombach organization, a private intelligence organization sponsored by corporate interests working on contract to the CIA and State Department, but never under their official control, represents a prototype for some of the same corporate-sponsored intelligence organizations which operated in conjunction with and parallel to the CIA and other intelligence agencies that we took a look at in the fascist milieu, the petroleum intelligence fascist milieu that we looked at in connection with the assassination of President Kennedy. Recall the Empire Trust Company, companies like DeGolyer and McNaughton, and some of the corporations which put together their own private CIAs and which worked in conjunction with the main CIA. And many of these operatives were involved with the assassination of John Kennedy, as we have seen. Continuing with Simpson's analysis of the Grombach organization, Grombach worked simultaneously under contract to the Department of State and the CIA. The ex-military intelligence man succeeded in creating, quote, one of the most unusual organizations in the history of the federal government, unquote, according to CIA Inspector General Lyman Kirkpatrick. Quote, it was developed completely outside of the normal governmental structure, but it used all of the normal cover and communications facilities normally operated by intelligence organizations, and yet never was under any control from Washington, unquote. Again, it was developed completely outside of the normal governmental structure, but it used all of the normal cover and communications facilities normally operated by intelligence organizations, and yet never was under any control from Washington. By the early 1950s, the U.S. government was bankrolling Grombach's underground activities at more than $1 million annually, Kirkpatrick has said. Continuing, we're going to see now how Grombach goes to work, puts his organization to work for Senator Joe McCarthy. Also, recall that as we looked at in Radio Free America program number two, Joe McCarthy's main political backers were two German-American industrialists named Walter Harnischfeger and Frank Sensenbrenner, both of whom were very sympathetic to Hitler and active on behalf of Hitler prior to World War II, and that Joe McCarthy, among other things, conducted a brutal grilling of former American servicemen who had been involved with as victims or witnesses to the Malmedy massacre during the Battle of the Bulge, and basically accused them of being pro-communist or, quote, Jewish, unquote, and of maligning the Third Reich and driving Germany into the arms of the communists. Bear in mind that, again, Joe McCarthy himself, an individual with some pretty ripe political views, some of them actually overlapping directly with some of the Third Reich people that we've looked at in this particular archive show. Note also that many McCarthy-aligned elements, such as Robert Morris, were involved with the milieu that killed President Kennedy, not necessarily directly involved, but certainly involved with many of the elements and individuals who were instrumental in the assassination of President Kennedy. Continuing here with Simpson's account of Grombach's activities on behalf of Joe McCarthy. Through a quirk of fate, Frenchy Grombach found himself in a position where he could exercise enough influence in Washington to help derail the government careers of his rivals. U.S. government contracts bankrolling a network of former Nazis and collaborators gave him much of the ammunition he needed to do the job. Grombach had used his networks primarily to gather dirt. This was the American agent's specialty, his true passion, political dirt, sexual dirt, any kind of compromising information at all. Quote, he got into a lot of garbage pails, unquote, as Kirkpatrick puts it, and again quoting, and issued dirty linen reports on Americans. Grombach collected scandal, cataloged it, and used it carefully, just as he had done during the earlier McCormick investigation. By the way, that was the derailing of the OSS's RNA branch. Continuing, he leaked smears to his political allies in Congress and the press when it suited his purposes to do so. Grombach and congressional internal security investigators bartered these dossiers with one another almost as though they were boys trading baseball cards. One of Grombach's most important weapons in his struggle for power was a series of blackmail-type dossiers that his men had compiled on his rivals inside the U.S. intelligence community. He had retailed much of this data, piece by piece, to the CIA over the years, but by 1952 had decided to make use of his network of former SS men and collaborators on behalf of Senator Joseph McCarthy. Grombach's primary targets included a number of current and former U.S. intelligence officials: Charles Thayer, T-H-A-Y-E-R, Carmel Offie, O-F-F-I-E, William Bundy, Colonel Alfred McCormick, M-C, capital C-O-R-M-A-C-K, and a half dozen others whom he regarded as vulnerable liberal targets. Grombach leaked these dirty linen files to Senator McCarthy, according to both Kirkpatrick and Letallo. Soon, an anonymous letter went the rounds on Capitol Hill, charging Thayer with sexual promiscuity, homosexuality, and a series of vague security violations during Thayer's tenure as chief of the Voice of America, which was a frequent target of McCarthy's attacks. Other charges soon flowed out of McCarthy's offices about William Bundy, then a member of the CIA's elite Office of National Estimates, and John Peyton Davies, D-A-V-I-E-S, who had been George Kennan's right-hand man in Operation Bloodstone. That was one of the early Nazi utilization projects on behalf of U.S. intelligence. Continuing, skipping down, McCarthy let it be known that he intended to call Charles Thayer for hearings on his supposed fitness for office, perhaps at the same time that the nomination of Thayer's brother-in-law, Charles Bohlen, as ambassador to the USSR was up for consideration. Bohlen is B-O-H-L-E-N. The hearings, like most McCarthy events, would probably receive live national TV coverage. Thayer resigned a few days later. A simple resignation was not enough for McCarthy, however. The State Department had permitted Thayer to maintain the fiction that he had voluntarily resigned, quote, to pursue a writing career, unquote, and had even put out a press release to that effect. But McCarthy insisted on making Thayer's public humiliation complete. Under intense questioning by the senator, a department spokesman admitted that Thayer had been, quote, separated on the basis of morals charges, unquote, a 1950s euphemism for homosexuality. Newspapers headlined the case from coast to coast. That was one down. Next on McCarthy's list, and on Grombach's, was John Peyton Davies. Davies, a China policy specialist and close friend of George Kennan's, had frequently served as the policy planning staff's point man in Bloodstone cases. He had been instrumental in the immigrations of Nazi Foreign Office specialist Hilger and the SS Wannsee Institute defector Papa in the exploitation of former Nazi agents Ulus and Sunch, and in much of the rest of the clandestine side of State Department affairs during the Truman administration. Names, by the way, Hilger again, H-I-L-G-E-R. Papa is P-O-P-P-E. Ulus is U-L-U-S, and Sunch is S-U-N-S-H. Continuing. Davies generally favored a hardline attitude toward Moscow, and even went so far as to advocate a, quote, preventive war against the USSR, unquote, as the New York Times described it, following the detonation of the first Soviet atomic bomb in 1949. In a more recent interview, however, Davies denied that he called for war with the Soviets, preferring instead to term his strategy a, quote, showdown, unquote. Ironically, though, Davies had become the whipping boy of the right-wing China lobby during the late 1940s because of his controversial opinions on American strategy in the Far East. He had once, in 1945, favored a de facto U.S. alliance with Mao Zedong in order to undermine Soviet influence in Asia. Davies' advice on this matter was largely rejected, but after Mao's victory in 1949, the far right in the United States scapegoated Davies and other State Department China hands as the supposed cause of Chiang Kai-shek's defeat. The sacrifice of John Peyton Davies at McCarthy's hands is a vivid illustration of the influence of the radical right on American political affairs. It's worth noting here before we continue that many of the people who were targets of McCarthy's ire here had actually been deeply involved in some of the Nazi utilization programs conducted by U.S. intelligence during the closing days of World War II, or during the post-World War II period. Continuing, Charles Bohlen, a close Kennan ally, who was, according to his own account, beginning again, Charles Bohlen, a close Keenan ally, who, according to his own account, had been instrumental in the original recruitment of German political warfare expert Hans Heinrich Herwarth for U.S. intelligence, was next. Eisenhower had nominated Bohlen as U.S. ambassador to the USSR in February of 1953, but the nomination had to be confirmed by the Senate before Bohlen could take his post. Ike liked and respected Chip Bohlen. They had been golf partners in France during the 40s. Eisenhower had personally chosen Bohlen for the Moscow assignment, much to the discomfort of his Secretary of State, John Foster Dulles. Arthur Bliss Lane, Joe McCarthy, and the rest of the liberationist stalwarts balked at the Bohlen nomination. Even Secretary of State Dulles was concerned about how Bohlen's earlier leading role in containment and in the 1945 Yalta Accords with the USSR might look to voters who had just elected the Republicans on a liberation ticket. Skipping down again, and by the way, take note here that the main witness against Charles Bohlen is a fellow named Igor Bogolepov, B-O-G-O-L-E-P-O-V. And again, Bohlen had brought Heinz Heinrich Herwarth, a major Third Reich political warfare specialist, into the U.S., but that wasn't good enough for McCarthy. And the main witness against Bohlen in the congressional hearings, the senatorial confirmation process, was a fellow named Igor Bogolepov, who was an NTS man, again, the National Toilers Alliance of the Solidarists, elements of which worked for the Third Reich, then U.S. intelligence, and elements of which, as we have seen, were involved in the assassination of John Kennedy. Continuing. McCarthy presented his trump card at the climax of his argument. It was an affidavit from Igor Bogolepov, who claimed that he knew that the Soviet secret police had regarded Bohlen as a, quote, possible source of information, unquote, and a, quote, friendly diplomat, unquote, during a Bohlen tour of duty in Moscow in the 1930s. Bogolepov was an NTS man who freelanced as an anti-communist expert in Washington. In the early 1950s, he was on a number of payrolls, including Grombach's and the State Department's. Letalo says that it was Grombach who primed Bogolepov for his role in McCarthy's attack on Bohlen. Bogolepov had once been a Soviet foreign ministry official, but he defected to the Nazis and spent most of World War II making anti-Semitic propaganda broadcasts for the Goebbels ministry. Bogolepov says that U.S. intelligence brought him to this country in the late 1940s, apparently illegally considering his work for Goebbels, and that he had worked on and off for the CIA for several years. In time, however, Bogolepov grew discontented with the agency, mainly because it did not pay him as much as he thought he deserved. The cooler heads on Capitol Hill considered Bogolepov a crackpot. The radical right, however, did not and readily used his statements as, quote, proof, unquote, that, among other things, communist fellow travelers were engaged in a campaign to rewrite U.S. Army training manuals and that Charles Bohlen was, quote, possibly, unquote, an undercover Stalinist agent. Even Bogolepov's affidavit failed to bail out McCarthy this time. The senator was outvoted, and Bohlen's nomination was approved. The New York Times carried the entire affair on its front page and prominently quoted the NTS man's affidavit. The Russian defector's stint in the Goebbels ministry, which had been made public in earlier congressional testimony, was not mentioned in the report. McCarthy succeeded in drawing some blood despite losing the vote on Bohlen. According to columnists Joseph and Stuart Alsop, Republican Majority Leader Robert Taft visited Eisenhower shortly after the vote. Taft insisted that, quote, no more Bohlens, unquote, be sent to the Senate as nominees. Eisenhower agreed, the Alsops reported, and Taft, quote, hastened to spread the happy word on Capitol Hill that Senator McCarthy and his ilk would thereafter enjoy a virtual veto on all presidential appointments, unquote. The Alsops were overstating the case, perhaps, but it was clear enough that McCarthy had demonstrated his power as a spoiler in the Senate. Eisenhower's diplomatic nominations were screened for their acceptability to the extreme right for much of the rest of his administration. So again, even though Charles Bohlen was not deep-sixed as a result of the activities of Mrs. McCarthy and Grombach and Bogolepov, and again, note that Bogolepov had originally worked for Goebbels' propaganda ministry, later the CIA, and finally freelanced on behalf of Grombach and McCarthy, this did have a significant effect on Eisenhower's appointments policies. However, one of the most important things to note, and I'm going to wrap this installment of the broadcast up with this last section of blowback, is that even though the Eisenhower administration was elected in considerable measure as a result of the pro-liberation campaign that was conducted by Arthur Bliss Lane, working at the same time for NCFE and for CFF, and even though his appointments were affected by the combined activities of Grombach's Third Reich emigre and in conjunction with Joe McCarthy's attacks, the Eisenhower administration basically remained committed to the containment versus the rollback philosophy. What we're going to look at next week is how this the fascist milieu involving an intersection of the national security establishment, the American radical right, and these Third Reich emigre, George Bush being part of that axis, this explicitly fascist milieu, we're going to take a look at how they were dissatisfied with the Eisenhower administration next week, and how political warfare and psychological warfare ultimately was transformed or replaced by the use of covert action and deadly force, that with the assassination of John Kennedy, but that will be next week. Even though, again, despite the activities of Messrs. McCarthy and Grombach and Bogolyubov, despite the synthesis of the liberation campaign and the liberation philosophy introduced into the United States as a result of CIA domestic activity, chiefly CFF, bear in mind originally this was a Third Reich political warfare strategy and covert action strategy introduced into the U.S. by these Galen-related elements and through CIA activity, the Eisenhower administration remained committed to containment rather than rollback philosophy. And ultimately, as we'll look at next week, Eisenhower began to seek detente with the Soviet Union. That did not sit well with the milieu which assumed power on 11-22-63. Of Eisenhower's ultimate sticking, his ultimate commitment to containment rather than liberation or rollback theory, Simpson writes as follows. But despite the Republicans' public attacks on Truman's containment policy, Eisenhower's election had been a victory for the Republican establishment, not for the radical right. The Republicans did not have a substantially new strategy for dealing with the Soviets, beyond a tendency to use harsher rhetoric than the Democrats. George Kennan's containment theories may have seemed like part of the problem to most liberation advocates, but his thinking on clandestine political warfare against the Soviets was most welcome to Eisenhower and dominated the scene at the Solarium strategy conferences. Eisenhower himself personally endorsed Kennan's stratagems, his analysis of East-West affairs, and the former diplomat himself. The president and his advisors decisively renewed the ongoing program of harassment and destabilization inside Eastern Europe that had given birth to the Nazi utilization efforts in the first place. And again, next week, we will begin looking at dissatisfaction on behalf of the rollback or liberation milieu, the milieu that ascended on November 22, 1963, and we're going to take a look at how ultimately the dissatisfaction, first with Eisenhower, and then their complete revulsion with Kennedy, led to a fascist coup, literally the overthrow of the legitimate constitutional authority in the United States, the assassination of John Kennedy, and in succeeding installments we will see how the liberation milieu evolved into the Reagan administration and the current state of affairs, both in the United States and in the rest of the world. This concludes this installment of Radio Free America program number 37, How the United States Lost the Second World War.